Brother, you know, well, my name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our group is the third oldest group in the state of Maryland, and when our group was started, you had one town, you had one meeting. And who knew, a few resentments and a couple of coffee pots later, we got 15 groups and 50-some meetings, so that's how we do it here in AA. I want to thank the committee, particularly Denise, for inviting me to be here this evening. Although Doug approached me shortly after I arrived here today to inform me that he was responsible for my being here tonight. And I asked Denise about that, and she said, well, please, by all means, give Doug the credit for being responsible, because he's generally pretty irresponsible. So I think it's real important that you know who's responsible for my being here tonight, because if I say anything that offends you in the next 2.5 hours here together, then you take that up with Doug. So who's responsible for my being here tonight? And if I should happen to say something you agree with, by all means, see me after the meeting, because I can use those attaboys. Now, we had a nice dinner this evening. I want to thank Doug and Jeff and Benny and Brian for providing companionship there at the table. And I certainly don't want to overlook Rob. But Rob's a little self-absorbed, and he told me that he'd give me $10 if I mentioned Rob's name 3 times in this week. So see me after the meeting, Rob. And thank you, Minneapolis St. Paul, for one heck of a party in the year 2000. That was wonderful. My wife and I had the privilege of coming to be with you back then, and we stayed with our friends Ted and Jean, and I'm happy to say that they're here with us this evening, and I'm honored by their presence here, along with their son Colin and his wife Mary, and a really good Al-Anon lady named Bev that we met 8 years ago when we were here. And it's great to be here with all of you. My mom is 93 years old. She was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years. I called her this evening before coming down here to remind her where I was, and she said, well, are you out there to talk to one of those AA things? And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. And she said, you make sure you tell those people you are not an alcoholic. Now, my mom was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years, and she thinks she knows a little bit about alcoholism. And quite frankly, I'd like to start listening to my mom. I think it's about time. And I mean, there is a chance I may have overreacted to this whole thing. So There was some mention made in the announcements about cell phones, and if we're alcoholics like I'm alcoholic, I really do not like being told what to do. And quite frankly, when told what to do, I generally do the opposite. So if you're here tonight and you have a cell phone with you, by all means, turn that puppy on. Particularly if you're expecting a liver transplant, but if you could put it on vibrate, that would be a big help, because that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you won't disturb the rest of it. I'd like to say that drinking didn't interfere with my life early on. Alcohol did for me what I'm sure it did for you. It has adjusted my perception of the reality of my life. It allowed me to do things while drinking which I could not do when not drinking. As soon as I began drinking, I knew immediately why my father drank. I thought it was a shame that he couldn't control his drinking like I could, but I knew why he drank. And I used to say it never caused me any trouble in high school, but with good sponsorship, I now recognize the fact that I spent 5 years in high school is a little unusual. And of course, I thought it was because of a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but it really turns out it was the drinking. I went to a community college after high school, and one summer my good friend Bill and I had decided that we were going to take a road trip. We were going to drive to California and from Maryland, and we got 12 cases of beer and put them in the back of my car, and we each packed an overnight bag, and we had everything you need for a trip to California. And the night before we were to leave, his father told him that he could not go. I was crushed. Yeah. And I'm not going to drive to California by myself. Now, I give credit to Bill. He did give me his interest in the 12 cases of beer. And as many of you may know, the eastern border of the state of Maryland is on the Atlantic Ocean, and we have a resort community there called Ocean City. And so I took that 12 cases of beer and I went to Ocean City. And I lived there for a month as a bum. I didn't have a job. I had those 12 cases of beer to drink. I stayed in hotels where I knew people who were desk clerks and bellhops, and I ate leftover restaurant food from restaurants where people I knew were waiters and waitresses. So I didn't have to pay anything for room, and I didn't have to pay anything for board. I had 12 cases of beer to drink. I had a pocket full of money left over from when I quit my job. And I had such a great month there in Ocean City, I decided I wanted to work in Ocean City the following summer. But I'm a keen observer of my surroundings, and if you drank like I drank, and you acted like I acted, over the course of the summer, there was a real good chance you would get arrested. It didn't make any difference if you were a lifeguard, or a beach boy, or a bellhop, or a waiter, or a waitress, a bartender. I mean, they were getting arrested. But I noticed there was one group of people working in Ocean City who drank like I drank and acted like I acted, and they were not getting arrested. And they were the members of the Ocean City Police Department. So I became a police officer. Kathy, I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I can really see it or pay much attention to it, but I just think it gives hope to the newcomers. So we'll put it right there. When I went to Ocean City to be a police officer, they gave me a boardwalk beat. But within 7 or 10 days of my starting that job, it became apparent that I have a singularly unique talent that comes in mighty handy when you're a cop. And that is that I could spot an underage drinker from 100 yards. And I would pick out my target of opportunity. I would establish that indeed they were underage. I would ask what they had in the cooler. They would tell me they had some Coca-Cola in there, had some tuna fish and a loaf of bread. I'd ask them if they'd mind opening the cooler. They would lift the lid, and there, a nice even row would be the Coca-Cola. But I would reach way down into the bottom of that cooler, and invariably I'd come up with a Budweiser. And if you were that underage drinker, your life, as you have known it, has just ended because you're going to jail. Now, I know that you thought you were going to be going to college, but you're not. You're going to jail. No college is going to admit you when they find out you've been in the Ocean City jail. Maybe you were thinking about a military career. Well, it ain't happening, because you're going to jail. And the United States military doesn't need jailbirds like you in the military. As a matter of fact, I'm going to call your parents back in Baltimore at 3 a.m. in the morning, and I'm going to tell them that you are in the Ocean City Jail. What's that? You want to offer a compromise. What did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer. Well, that's certainly worthy of consideration. However, you do understand if I confiscate the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler. And if I take the cooler, I'm going to take the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. You're okay with that? Okay. Now, you're going to have to give me your word that you are never, ever going to do this again in Ocean City. You promise? Okay, you're free to go. Now, it is really hard
It is really hard to walk a boardwalk suit when you're dragging a cooler full of deer behind you. So I had to make an arrangement with my lieutenant and sergeant. They would come with their sidecar and they would pick up the coolers as I accumulated them. And then we would be at the end of the shift. And if I happened to come up with any whiskey or wine, I would give that to them and I would take the cooler and the beer and the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. And I had a good summer that summer. I drank every day. I didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer and I didn't get arrested. And that's my definition of a good summer. So I went back for a second summer, and the second summer I went back, they gave me my own squad car. Lights and sirens, yeah, woo, it was right. And it was one of those big old Ford Crown Victorias, and you can get like three bodies or five coolers in the trunk of one of those things. And so I expanded my territory. I really didn't need my lieutenant and sergeant like I used to, but they still maintained a keen interest in my activities. And at the end of every shift, I would meet them in the parking lot, and I would give them the whiskey and the wine, and I would take the coolers and the beer. And if you were a friend of mine coming to Ocean City, or even if you were a friend of a friend of mine, or even if I didn't even know you, and you just knew of me, if you need a cooler, come by my place. I'm your guy. I got a no return policy. Pick any cooler you want. Had them stacked up to the ceiling. Had a good summer that summer. I drank every day. Didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I didn't get arrested. So another good summer under my belt. I went back for a third summer. Now what I'm going to tell you happened that third summer, and it changed the course of my entire life. It was 3:00 in the morning. I was on the beach highway. I stopped the guy for drunk driving. I had him out of the car, obviously drunk. I was writing him up, and he said to me, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" I said, "No, sir, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." Well, I'm a college kid. I've never heard of I've never heard the term state's attorney before. I've got no idea what a state's attorney does. I've never seen one before. So I said, "Good for you. Sign the ticket." So he signed the ticket, and there was a guy there that appeared to be sober, and I let him drive. Finished off a shift at 8:00, pulled into the parking lot, and there was the chief of police. And he said, "Come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words that the chief had spoken to me all summer. And I thought, this was a good thing. I'm going to get recognition. Long overdue recognition, I might add. Good job, well done. And so I went up to his office, and when I walked into his office, much to my surprise, seated right inside the door on the couch was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3:00 in the morning. The chief said, "Give me that ticket book." I handed him the ticket book. He flips it open to the ticket. He hands the ticket book to the guy on the couch. The guy on the couch takes a pen out and writes across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed," and signs his name. It was at that moment I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could be one of those state's attorneys, I definitely wanted to be one of them. Because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic charges with a stroke of a pen was going to come in mighty handy. And so I went to law school. When I got out of law school, I went back to my hometown, Hagerstown. Been practicing 6 or 7 weeks when it became apparent to me that there was a vacancy over at the state's attorney's office. They were advertising for an assistant state's attorney. I went right over. Here I am, answer to your prayers. When would you like me to start? Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I thought I heard them say. You've had this experience, I can see that. Yeah. Turns out that many things that I thought were said during my life were never said. Many things that I thought I saw happen never happened. I have a problem with perception, and I have a problem with hearing. But this is what I thought I heard them say. "What? Are you some kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school.
You've never been in a courtroom. You've never tried a case. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never examined or cross-examined a witness. We don't have any time to train you. Get out of the office. That's what I thought I heard them say. In truth, I believe they said something to the effect that the job has already been filled. But I heard what I heard, and I'm a very sensitive person, and I don't suffer well. And I was hurt. I was angered. And I now know, as a result of good sponsorship, as I left that office with a resentment. Now, in Maryland, I'm sure like here in Minnesota, we elect our prosecutors. And I went out and I found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney. And he made me deputy state's attorney. Now, when you get to be deputy state's attorney, they give you a badge. And with that badge comes a badge case. And in that badge case, there is a clear plastic window, and you put your driver's license behind that. And when they pull you over and ask to see that license and registration, you show them that badge case. They don't look at that driver's license. They look at the badge. Or the badge officer, deputy state's attorney, Washington County. No, sir? No, I just have a few more miles to go. Yes, sir. I think I can keep it on my side of the road. Sure, yeah. No, I only had two or three. I am not upset that you stopped me. No, sir, I understand you're merely doing your job. Yes, sir. Well, thank you so much, officer. I very much appreciate the professional courtesy, and you have a nice evening, too. Now, some of you might be getting a little insight into why I've never been arrested. But it gets better. My boss, who was the state's attorney, was to be appointed circuit court judge. And if he got appointed circuit court judge, I was going to get appointed state's attorney. Well, I don't know how it is here in Minnesota, but back in Maryland, every now and then the local state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong and screws the whole thing up. And that's what happened in this case, and somebody else got appointed judge. Now, I was upset for my friend. But I was really upset that I didn't get to be state's attorney. I mean, I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And so one night, while having some adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, we determined that that something ought to be done about that state senator. Somebody ought to run against him. So I ran for the state senate. I didn't know the senator was going to run away with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee and abandon his wife and children and move to Florida, but he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate, and that license plate says state senator. Now, this is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate and they got those overheads going and they get close enough that they can see that license plate, they turn those overheads out. And they come up alongside of you and they turn that interior dim light on. And they toot. Tee-tee. Hi, Senator. Hi, Cooper. Hold it down, Senator. Go through, Cooper. And that way, you don't have a bunch of state police officers tied up alongside of the highway with members of the General Assembly, and they could be out arresting real crooks. So, now that guy who got appointed circuit court judge, he didn't like that job, so he quit. And I went over to see the governor. As I'm state senator, I'd like you to appoint my guy. That is my friend, the state's attorney. I'd like you to appoint him circuit court judge. Governor said, can't do it, won't do it. Too much adverse publicity associated with that last appointment, so I'm not going to appoint your guy. However, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you.
Well, it's a 15-year term, and there's only two of us in our community, so I became the circuit court judge. I'd like to think that I was an asset to the Bar Association. An example I'd cite for you is that one night they were doing a continuing legal education program on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving. They needed somebody, Sergeant Long was there with his breathalyzer. They needed somebody to drink the beer and blow into the breathalyzer. Somebody who was fair, impartial, unbiased, and okay, I'll help out any way I can. So they brought out six beers in this little tray, and I said to the guy, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, that's the beer for tonight's program." I said, "Well, you understand this is a two-hour program, and you only brought out six beers." He said, "Well," he said, "we have plenty back in the back." I said, "You better ice some down and bring it out, because I'm not drinking any warm beer." And so I started drinking, and every 15 minutes I'd blow into the breathalyzer, and you know, you jump off at like, you know, 0.05, and you bump it up to like a 0.11, and a 0.17, and 0.23, and 0.29, and 0.33, and that's when they called upon me to put on my part of the program, which I'm told was quite good under the circumstances. And so after the program was over, I asked them, who's going to drive me home? And they said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Just do a 0.33 in Sergeant Long's breathalyzer. I can't go out and get in the car." He said, "Geez," he said, "we never thought about that." I said, "Well, I'll just go into the bar here and I'll have a couple drinks. You come and get me when Sergeant Long's gone." And so I did, and they did, and then I went down to the Broad Axe and had three or four drinks down there, and then I went over to the cellar door and had a couple drinks, and then I went home, and that was just an evening of social drinking for the judge. And April 7, 1982, a lawyer and I were going out to get drunk. We told my wife we were going out to dinner, but he and I both knew we were going out to get drunk. This was not one of those occasions when I allowed myself to be negligently overserved. I mean, our stated purpose was to go out and get D-Walk and snot flying drunk, and that we did. We did. And we ended up at a local honky-tonk, and trust me on this. If I had any idea that this was going to be my last drink of beverage alcohol, believe me, I would have ordered something different. Because if I had any idea whatsoever that I was going to end up in May 2008 standing in a ballroom before you fine folks to talk to you about my last drink of beverage alcohol, well, as you're going to hear in a moment, it's embarrassing. There's a certain amount of shame associated with this. I mean, my drink of choice is Jack Daniel's Black Label and Crushed Ice with a Twist of Lemon. Now, that's my drink of choice. Now that I've told you that, I have to tell you this, that my last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. No, no. How do you think I feel? There are people in this audience who have no idea what Tia Maria is. And that's a good thing. Believe me. If you're planning on going back out, don't go back out for Tia Maria, because you're going to be sorely disappointed, I'll tell you that. My wife's a school teacher, and she teaches elementary school, and I imagine the elementary school children in Maryland are like the elementary school children here in Minnesota. They're just covered with germs. Those germs get on the teachers, and the teachers then come home, and then the spouse gets sick. And I got up the next day, I had flu. I couldn't believe it. Flu! Them pesky little kids had done it to me again. So I went to work, though. It was Thursday. I went to work, and the next day was a Good Friday, and so the courthouse was closed. I didn't have to go to work. I did, however, develop that upset stomach thing that frequently goes along with flu. And by Saturday, I developed that lower tract of stress that you can get with flu. And if you got that lower tract of stress combined with that upset stomach thing, I mean, that'll hone your decision-making down to a fine edge. But you don't know whether to sit or kneel or sit. And on at least one occasion that weekend, I made the wrong decision. And if my wife was here, you could talk to her about that, but she's not. And so on Easter Sunday, I wasn't feeling so good either. And on Monday, they put me in the hospital because I was very dehydrated from all of that kneeling and sitting that I'd been doing over the weekend. And that night, my abdomen became distended, and they did an emergency laparotomy on me, and they opened me up, and they found out my abdomen was full of peritonitis, gangrene. And while they were trying to clean that up, my kidneys quit. And my liver was enlarged and out of whack. And my pancreas was digesting itself. And my respiratory system quit. And things were just not looking good for the home team. I spent three weeks in intensive care in the Hagerstown Hospital, and my condition was deteriorating. They got me off the respirator, but that's about all they could do, and they finally decided that they'd send me down to Johns Hopkins. And I thought this was a good thing, because I knew people who had died in the Washington County Hospital, and I knew people who had gone to Johns Hopkins, and they'd lived. And I told my wife they were sending me to Johns Hopkins to die, because they just didn't think there was anything else could be done for me. And I'm kind of glad they didn't tell me that, because I'd have been discouraged if they had told me that. But I went down to Hopkins, and for 2 weeks they did everything but hang me by my thumbs. They did all kinds of tests, poking and prodding. And my belly button birthday was on May the 14th. And on May the 13th, these two learned physicians who were in charge of my case came into my room, and before they could really say much of anything, I told them that I just couldn't take it anymore, and I needed a day of rest. And they said, well, we've presented your case to the internal medicine department here at Hopkins, and we can't get a majority vote on what's wrong with you. So that's why we're here to tell you we are going to give you a day of rest tomorrow. And so I turned 40 at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And 2 weeks later, on May the 28th, I was discharged from the Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidney function returned. My liver started to reduce in size and to come back to the normal limits. My pancreas stopped digesting itself. And to be in the hospital for 7 weeks like that, as a matter of fact, I guess this is like, what, the 24th or something like that? I was in my seventh week at Johns Hopkins. I got out on the 28th. So 26 years ago tonight, I was in intensive care at Johns Hopkins. I know what a bad day is. This is a good day. That was a bad day. So when you're in there like 7 weeks like that, they like to talk to you about the do's and don'ts when they send you home. But if you've got an undiagnosed illness, they don't know what to tell you. In my case, they say, Judge, we just suggest you don't get it again, because if you get it again, it's likely to kill you. And, so I'm just about ready to walk out of that office, and one of these doctors says to me, can we ask you one more question, Judge? And, sure, what's that? He said, do you drink? Yeah. What question is that? I mean, I'm a lawyer. Well, I used to be a lawyer. I'm a judge. When I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. I had to drink with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I've got to drink with other with lawyers, and I've got to drink with other judges. It's a professional obligation. How much do you drink? Not much. Why do you ask? Well, you know, nothing destroys the kidneys like alcohol. And your kidney function has just returned, and we don't know what alcohol would do to it. And then there's nothing that impacts the liver like alcohol. And your liver is just, we don't know if there's any permanent damage to your liver or not. But if you drank any alcohol, we don't know what would happen. And your pancreas has stopped digesting itself, and there's nothing that destroys the pancreas like alcohol. And so you got these three vital, very sensitive organs involved, and we just think you should not drink for a while.
How long? A year.
Ooh, a year. Well, I haven't had anything to drink since April the 7th. This is May 28th. They said, no, Judge, you don't understand. We want you, this is a Memorial weekend, we want you to not drink for 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I know that there are people in this ballroom this evening who have already discerned the injustice that these two doctors were trying to force upon me because I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. And I want you to know that an argument broke out between this knuckle-headed judge and these two learned physicians as to whether or not I would not drink until April the 7th or June the 1st. And we reached a compromise. And the compromise was I would not drink until next April the 7th. And then if I thought any of the pain, suffering, and misery that I had experienced had anything to do with drinking, then I could choose to not drink until June the 1st. Now, I need to tell you this. When I talk to people who aren't alcoholics, and I tell them about my insistence on defending my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety, they don't laugh. They look at me like I'm crazy. And of course, I am crazy. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I was invited here this evening. I mean, I'm here because I'm not all there. But this, of course, calls into question your sanity, since you're sitting here listening to me. I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital, May the 28th, into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking, not changing. Big Book says if you take alcohol away from the alcoholic becomes restless, irritable, and discontented. That is a gross understatement in my case. I was more pissed off in the spring-loaded position. And you see, with every passing day, with every passing week, with every passing month that I didn't drink, is proof positive that I do not have a problem with alcohol. As a matter of fact, I don't have any problems whatsoever. But I'll admit I'm a little touchy. Alright? I'm a little bit on edge. I'm a little irritable. Yeah, I am a little irritable. Do you know what I'm irritable about? Is you won't mind your own darn business, okay? If you would leave me alone and just do what you should be doing and leave me out of it, I wouldn't be having a problem. You wouldn't be having this problem. I am fine. Fine. Tell me, how'd you like to have your DWI in front of me on Monday morning, huh? Yeah. Fine. Not drinking and not changing. It's almost like not drinking and going to meetings. I hope in Minnesota you don't tell alcoholics, don't drink and go to meetings. We kill alcoholics with that. Because for an alcoholic not to drink, and nothing else changes, I'm going to pick up a drink. Slow suicide. Or if in my case, where I was sure that I could not drink, people like me pick up guns. Or drive into bridge abutments. Fast suicide. And our sheriff back home had shot himself to death in the basement of the courthouse. In my office, my chambers was on the top floor of the courthouse. And I had concluded that if I were to shoot myself to death in my chambers, that that would add symmetry to the building. That was my best thinking. two friends of mine, Bob and Ken, were watching me die of untreated alcoholism. They were watching me die of untreated alcoholism. They were active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad, my alcoholic father, on July the 3rd, 1968, passing by a Methodist church in our community, read the message on the message board out front that said, "Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth." My father went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, never drank again. He died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program. I carried my dad's 15-year chip with me, along with my chip, and I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous for what Alcoholics Anonymous did for my father. Gave him back his life. Gave him back his dignity. Gave him back his self-respect. Made him a man of integrity. I was and am tremendously proud of my father. And Ken and Bob both knew that my dad had died with 15 years of sobriety, and Bob came to me and said, "Jack, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a book. We call it the Big Book, and I thought maybe you'd like to read it, find out about your father's disease." Clever guy, that Bob. He would have said anything remotely close to, "We'd like you to read this so you could find out what's wrong with you." There's nothing wrong with me, so I'm not going to read it. But to find out about my father's disease, yes, I would be interested in that. And so I read the Big Book, and no surprise to me, my father's in there. "You're an alcoholic," as defined by the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't surprised. What did surprise me, however, is I was in there. That book was written before I was born. And yet there are things contained in that book which are part of my life experience. How could they have written something before I was born that described my life experience? And I went to Ken and to Bob, and I told them that having read the book and seen what I saw, that I was willing to admit, I was willing to concede, that there was a possibility, a remote possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, that I may have contracted a very mild case of alcoholism, but we caught it just in time. And that's all Ken and Bob needed, was that little chink in the armor. They began coming to my court chambers every Friday at noon. They'd bring a brown bag lunch with them, and they brought their big books. And I had my big book, and we would read from the big book, we'd say the Serenity Prayer, and we'd read from the big book, and Ken and Bob would explain to me the importance of what we had read, and I would explain to Ken and Bob as Jack sees it. As you can imagine, we had some very high-level intellectual discussions in my chambers. And I pointed out to Ken and to Bob that while it was true that I spent 5 years in high school, I thought it was important for them and to you to know that I graduated in 2 years from the community college with an associate's degree. 2 more years I graduated from the University of Maryland with a bachelor's degree. And 3 years after that, I graduated from the University of Maryland School of Law with a law degree, with honors, I might add. And Ken said, "Jack, we have degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them." I've never heard that before. I've learned a lot in AA since. They said this in my office. My office. You see, Ken and Bob knew that I was dying of untreated alcoholism, and I didn't know that. And they were willing to risk hurting my feelings because they knew my feelings had been hurt before and they knew that I would get over that. And they were willing to risk angering me because they knew that I had been angry before and that I would get over that. But if something didn't change, I was going to die of untreated alcoholism. And I would not get over that. So Ken and Bob knew something that I didn't know. And not only did they know something that I didn't know, they knew that I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And they also knew, had I known that they knew something that I didn't know, the mere fact that I knew that they knew something I didn't know, that fact, knowing that they knew something I didn't know, would make me angry. But they were persistent and consistent in bringing me the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they knew that there would come a day when I actually knew what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And then when I found out that they knew something I didn't know, my knowing that they knew something that I didn't know would no longer make me angry knowing that they knew something I didn't know, because by that time, I would know what they knew, and I would know what they knew, and that they would know that I knew it. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what you know that you know, and not a moment before. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you found some of that at least a bit confusing, you're still in the right place. Just means you don't know. On December 22, 1989, it was Friday before Christmas, and the courthouse was closed, so Ken and Bob and I could not have our big book study and our big book meeting in my chambers, so we went out to lunch. Now, I want to tell you this, that when I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. I think that's pretty conclusive evidence that drinking had nothing to do with any of those six separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all six of those separations, and we didn't know. Now, if I don't screw this thing up, come August of this year, my wife and I are going to be married 42 years. And if she were here, you'd probably want to give her a chip for that. But she's been married all 42 of those years, and I've had time off for bad behavior. So on December 22, 1989, my wife and I are separated. And so after lunch, Ken and Bob go their separate ways, and I go back to my apartment. Mailman has brought a package to my apartment, one of those Hickory Farms packages you see at Christmas time. Cheese log or sausage. Never seen them any other time of the year except for Christmas. But this is nice. Somebody sent the judge a sausage. So I took it into my apartment. I was taking answers off my answering machine. I had plans for that night. I had plans for the next night. I had a girlfriend. I had a backup girlfriend. I had a girlfriend for special occasions. My girlfriends objected to my wife. My wife objected to my girlfriends. And I explained to Ken and Bob that I'm managing all of this quite well. And if you're looking for a delusional thought, you just heard one. So I'm trying to open this package. I'm trying to listen to the messages on the answering machine. And I see where it's taped shut. And I cut the tape with my car key. And I'm writing down the message. And I lift the lid to this box. And boom! And I got blown back against the wall. And a federal appellate judge had been killed in 10 days before by an explosive device that had been sent to his home. And a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed 5 days before that by a bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I had opened the bomb. And there was a fire, and I tried to put it out. I couldn't. went out in the hallway and pulled the fire alarm. Neighbor came, said he had a fire extinguisher. I went back in and went to the telephone to call 911, and when I went to press the button on the phone, I became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. And after I finished that call, I hung the phone up, and it felt like somebody was trying to pull my hips, my pants off my hips. And I looked down at the floor, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I knew I was in serious trouble. And my neighbor came and said he'd put the fire out, and he asked if he could do anything else, and I asked him if he could get me a towel, and he did, and I opened my trousers, and I did not have the courage to try to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought I'd been injured, and I put my back against the wall, and I slid down onto the floor. And I was very afraid. And I was alone. And I was powerless. And the only tool I had as a result of my being with Ken and with Bob and reading the big book was I had the Serenity Prayer. And I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I couldn't change. And to give me the courage to change and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer. But I don't know if it was the fifth, sixth, or seventh time through that prayer, but all I can tell you is that God came. And I was overcome by a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I have never experienced before in my life. And I had no idea if I was going to live or die on that floor that afternoon. But I knew that if I died that afternoon on that floor, and I would never see my wife again or to see our three children again, it would be all right. It would be all right. When the police, fire, and rescue people burst through the door of my apartment and they were trying to talk to me and both my eardrums had been blown out and I really couldn't hear what they were saying, and so when I stopped praying, this tremendous wave of fear swept upon me and I told them, you guys do whatever you have to do, and I'm going back to doing what I was doing. And as soon as I started the Serenity Prayer again, that peace of sense of well-being returned. And they cut all the clothes, all my clothes off of me, with the exception of my red and green Christmas socks. They strapped me to a gurney and carried me down three flights of steps. And our local television station was standing on the spot, and they got the picture of my red and green Christmas socks sticking out the end of that ambulance. And those socks went around the world on CNN, and I went to the hospital where they prepared me for surgery. And they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken, and they let him come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And he had my hand, and he prayed for me, and he prayed with me. And they took me up to surgery, and I don't know how shrapnel knows how to stop passing through flesh. I can only tell you what they told me. They removed a significant piece of shrapnel, not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And I think we all know if my femoral artery had been nicked, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. And they took me up to a recovery room, and when I came to, at the foot of my bed was my sponsor, Bob. And let me say here, parenthetically, that it's good to have a sponsor. If you're here tonight and you're new and you don't have a sponsor, you know, get a sponsor before the weekend's over. You're going to need a sponsor. Sponsors see things differently. They have a different take on stuff. So, if you're new here, you get a sponsor. And even if you're not new here, if you're used here, and maybe you don't have the relationship you used to have with your sponsor, maybe your sponsor's moved away, or maybe you've grown apart, maybe you're doing that ism of alcoholism, that I sponsor myself thing that some of us try here. If you're there on that I sponsor myself thing, I don't mean to be unkind or rude, but you got an idiot for a sponsor. Bob was at the foot of my bed and he was smiling. I said, "Bob, I noticed that you're smiling. What are you smiling about?" He said, "Oh, not much, Jack." He said, "I just think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed." I said, "Can't be harmed, Bob? Somebody just tried to kill me." He said, "Yeah, I know, Jack." He said, "I understand that package you opened contained 4 pipe bombs." He said, "One pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. 2 pipe bombs are a little redundant. 3 pipe bombs, that's a bit around the bend. 4 pipe bombs, Jack, you have really made somebody very angry." He said, "Man has done his very best to kill you. And the only explanation for your survival is the grace of God." Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, "God has spared your life for a reason, Jack. God has work for you to do." I said, "Really, Bob? What kind of work does God have for me to do?" Bob said, "Jack, I wouldn't presume to know what's God's will for you in that regard. But I can tell you this. It's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with either me or with Ken. You're going to have to do that 4-step inventory. You're going to have to do that 5th step with Ken or myself. You're going to have to make that 6-step decision, pray that 7-step prayer, make that 8-step list, begin making those 9-step amends so you can live for good order in 10, 11, 12, and be a maximum service to God and to your fellow man." Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't come up with that one either. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that drinking is but a symptom of alcoholism. It says that the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. There's something wrong with my thinking. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous says that the succession of drinking is only the beginning. And in order for me to overcome alcoholism, I have to have what the book describes as a vital or necessary spiritual experience. A sufficient change of personality to overcome alcoholism. I got a problem with thinking. We've got this pamphlet as AA for you. These pamphlets are always being revised, and I've sent a recommendation up to General Services. Tell me what you think of this. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so and only lasted for a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connected with your thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever thought that your life would be better if you did not think? Simply how I think is my problem. In rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we say, because it's our experience. But I cannot think my way into right living. I can only live my way into right thinking. The chapter is into action. The chapter is not into thinking. When Ken and Bob were coming to my chambers and we were reading the Big Book every Friday, week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out, I had what I like to call cake mix sobriety. And by that I mean that we went out here to a grocery store and we bought one of those boxes of Duncan Hines Red Velvet cake mix. You can trust me on this. Duncan Hines has put on the back of that cake mix package a three-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. And if we had a box of that cake mix here, I could give it to Kathy and she could read it out loud to us. I could hand it down to the audience, we could pass it around and read those steps out one at a time to each other. And we could talk about it and we could discuss it, and I'm the kind of guy, having read the back of the box, I'm looking for my cake. I haven't done anything. Read the box. I haven't opened it. I haven't broken an egg. I'm reading the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, discussing it with Ken and Bob, and I'm looking around for recovery. I haven't done anything. Just read the book. Read the back of that cake mix box. I'm looking for my red velvet cake. I read the Big Book. Talked to you about it. Listened to you talk about it. Told you what I thought would happen to me if I ever did anything about it. But I haven't done anything. I'm looking for recovery. But like I said, the chapter is into action. It's not into thinking. So many wonderful things have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have time to really share so many of them with you. But here's something that happened to me. I love a good God shot. I love a good God shot. Polly talks about if you do these things, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Here's a great event that came to pass for me. I was there at Founders Day, and if you go to Founders Day and you get the package and you stay at the school, you get four or five meals there, and you live in the dormitory, and this was back in 97. And so we had breakfast, lunch, and dinner on Saturday, and they make you sit where they tell you. You don't get a choice. You fill in every chair down this side of the table, and then they send them down the other side. And somebody new sits across from you at every meal. And you meet some wonderful, wonderful recovering people. So it's Sunday morning, and I'm up in the dormitory bathroom, and a guy comes in, and he says, "Hi, I'm Woody from Baltimore." And I said, "Well, I'm Jack from Hagerstown." "Oh, I come to Hagerstown all the time," says Woody. I said, "What do you come up there for?" He says, "Me and my sponsor, we bring a meeting up to that prison every month." I said, "Wow, Woody, I'm embarrassed to talk to you." He said, "Why is that?" I said, "Because I live 10 miles from that prison, and I don't know a single person that takes a meeting in there. They would like to go with us." I'd really like to talk to you about that, Woody, but I got to get back to my room. I'll talk to you later. And so I went down to my room, and I told my buddy Glenn what had happened. And he said, "Did you give him your telephone number, Jack?" I said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Jack, there's 15,000 people here this weekend. He will never find you." And I took comfort in that. So we went over to the dining hall to get our breakfast, and having gotten our tray, we went to be seated, and every chair. "Now we're coming down the other side. Okay, here they come. I wonder who's going to sit across from me." Woody. Not over here. Not over there. Right here. Now, as a retired circuit court judge, it is the last thing, it's the very last thing that I want to do, is to take meetings into a prison. But my sponsor, Ken, had told me that I get what I get because I do what I do. And if I keep doing the stuff I've always done, I'm going to keep getting the stuff I've always gotten. And if I want to get stuff I've never had before, I'm going to have to do stuff I've never done before. Which means I have to suspend my thinking. And I got to do stuff I don't want to do. And I recognize God's hand when it moves in my life. And so I began taking meetings in the prisons. And it's the greatest thing I've ever done in recovery. And if you have an opportunity to do it, I suggest you suspend your thinking and go into those jails and go into those prisons, because there are alcoholics in there. Our brothers and sisters are in there, and they're dying of untreated alcoholism. And they need us to come in there. And don't worry, you'll get to go home at the end of the evening. It was a really cold day in Western Maryland back some years ago, and I saw an ad that said, "Be a lawyer in paradise." And Republic of Palau was looking for assistant attorneys general, and so I fired off a resume. And went home that night. My wife said, "Anything interesting happen?" And I said, "Not really. It works today." I said, "Not really. I applied for a job in the Republic of Palau." She said, "Where's that?" I said, "I don't know, but it's warmer than it is here." To make a really long story short, I eventually went to the embassy of Palau to talk to them about this job to be assistant attorney general. They told me that their attorney general had determined he wasn't going to renew his contract and would I be interested in talking to them about becoming the attorney general of the Republic of Palau. I asked them if it paid more than the assistants. They said that it did, and so I talked to them about it. 6 months later, I became the Attorney General of the Republic of Palau. I called New York and asked them if they have any AA meetings in Palau. You see, Palauans are the second highest per capita consumer of Anheuser-Busch products in the world. It seemed to me there might be an opportunity there. Well, there were no meetings in Palau, so they sent me a starter kit, and I went out to Palau to be the Attorney General. Within 72 hours of being there, I found out about a guy named Bill Perrycour, who might know something about AA, so I called him. And I asked him if he was a friend of Bill W.'s, and he said he was. And I asked him if there were meetings in Palau, and he said, "Yes, they meet Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the National Hospital." And I said, "You didn't tell New York." He said, "I didn't know I had to tell New York." I said, "Well, you really don't have to tell them. They're just interested in stuff like that." He said, "Why don't you come to the meeting tonight?" And I said, "I will." Now, when you're going to a new meeting for the first time, you want to make a good impression. So I laid out all of my AA t-shirts. I had a black one that said, "First things first." I think you all know you don't wear black in a tropical climate. I have no idea why I even brought this shirt with me. I'm looking at my white shirts. The little black shirts going, "Wear me, wear me, wear me." I hate it when they do that. But in order to shut the voice up, I put the shirt on. And I went up to the National Hospital and I found the AA meeting. And there were 3 Americans there and 4 Palauans there. And they welcomed me to the First Things First group of Korea Palau. And I love it when God does a bank shot just to show off. Just to let me know that I'm in the right place and that He's in charge. Well, the longer I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, the less I know. But here's something that I know, without a doubt. I'm here this evening in Alcoholics Anonymous because somebody prayed. And if you're alcoholic, like I'm alcoholic, you're here this evening because somebody prayed. Maybe a lot of somebody's prayed. Now, you may or may not like that, I don't know, and I really don't care. It's just true. There's somebody here tonight in this group, maybe more than one of you, who are absolutely bound and determined not to attend this meeting. And yet, here you are. And there's some other people here who have been sent here to hear something. I don't know what you were sent here to hear, but I know that you're here. Here's a fact I think we can all agree upon without any argument whatsoever.
that this group of people assembled here, right now, have never been assembled together in the history of the world, and we will never be assembled together again. And our book says, there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here, right now. We have this pamphlet. Pamphlet's called A Member's Idea of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that you're all familiar with it. I hope everyone in this room has read it, but somehow I think not. I think this is the finest piece of AA literature that we have in our fellowship outside of the Big Book. If you have not read this, that was my opinion, by the way. If you have not read this pamphlet, you don't have an opinion. Let me read to you from the end of this pamphlet. This coming Sunday in the churches of many of us, where we read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst. And that the word gospel meant, quite literally, the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. If they were here this evening and they were to ask me, tell us, Jack, what did you find? I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see. The lame do walk. The lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead rise. And over again in the middle of the longest day of the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 7th, 1982. Thank you for letting me share.